This is listener-supported public radio for the Central Kenai Peninsula. KDLL, 91.9 FM, Kenai Seoul Dotna. I'm Jenny Nyman, and it's time for the Kenai Conversation. February is Black History Month. To mark that occasion, we're going to share a presentation on Black history in Alaska, part of the Mothers of Black History series, told by Skywalker Payne of Homer. Payne's latest project is RACES, which stands for Race, a Concept Explored in Story. The group met over Zoom, hosted by the Homer Public Library, and a free download of Black History in the Last Frontier can be found on the National Park Service's website. Search for Black History in the Last Frontier. Here's Claudia Haynes from the Homer Public Library introducing Skywalker Payne.
For those of you that are here, welcome. My name is Claudia Haynes here with the Homer Public Library, and I'm so glad to see many faces returning for week three of the Mothers of Black History. There will be moments where you'll be able to ask questions and kind of chime in. As in the past weeks, we are going to record tonight's session once Skywalker starts speaking. And we do that so that you can go back and revisit the stories, or people who can't make it tonight will be able to do that. And Skywalker and I are working on a book list of recommended reading, as well as characters and sources that Skywalker has talked about throughout this series. And we'll send that to everyone who's registered. I am so happy to turn tonight's story circle over to Skywalker so we can enjoy the evening together, even though we're separate.
Welcome, and thank you for coming. And last week I forgot to say this, but this week I'm remembering that I'm dedicating these performances in memory of all who have passed on physically in the past year for whatever reason, because we've lost more than usual. And as the African saying says, as long as you're remembered, you're not really dead. So tonight's going to be a little bit different. I'm on a new computer, so that's always challenging and interesting. And we are going to have Alaska stories, but we're going to start off with a folktale. And I was telling Claudia, folktales, at least African-American, they don't have a whole lot of folktales that feature women. African folktales do. There's a lot in Africa. But this folktale is more symbolic of what the stories I'm going to be telling. And it comes from Asia. And there once was a hunter who was walking through the woods. Every year he went hunting, but he heard this strange sound of a bird. And it went, na, 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 na. So he walked toward the sound and came to a tree and saw sitting on one of the branches, this most beautiful golden bird. And the bird sang, na, 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 na. And he said, why are you such a beautiful bird singing such an ugly song? Na, 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 na. And so the hunter, being a hunter, took out his bow and arrow and shot it at the bird, but he missed her. And she sang, na, 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 na. And so then he aimed carefully with his arrow, and he shot her straight in the heart and held his bag, and she fell right into the bag, and he tied it up and he started walking back home. And then he heard, no, 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 no. But he took that bag home with that bird and pulled the bird out, took all the feathers off, plucked it, chopped her up to 100 pieces. But then in the water, the water's boiling, and he hears, now he's getting a little freaked out. So he takes that pot with all those bird pieces and walks out into his land and gets a shovel and digs a deep, deep, deep hole and pours that pot with all those bird pieces in the hole, covers it with dirt, and is walking home and hears. Now he's really angry. He digs it all up and goes out and gets a big chest, and he puts all the pieces in the chest, and he puts this big chain around it and puts a lock on the chain and an anchor, and he puts it in his boat, and he goes out on his boat to the middle of the water and drops it where it's at the deepest. And he waits a few minutes and he doesn't hear anything and he goes back home. Now, meanwhile, that chest floats down the river. The anchor gets broken and the box ends up floating and landing on some beach. And one day some children come and find it. And they say, hey, this might be a treasure chest. And they get a rock and break the lock and lift it up. And they don't find treasure. Instead, 100 golden birds are flying out of the box. And they are amazed. And the birds begin to sing. Na, 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 na. Now, a year passes. And that same hunters walking through the same forest, hunting. And he can't believe his ears when he hears in the distance, na, 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 na. And then he walks straight there and looks up and sees not one, but 100 golden birds singing gloriously. Na, 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 na. And he stands there and he says, I know who you are. You cannot be killed. You are the freedom bird. And they sing, na, 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 na. And the freedom bird is an example and an explanation of how Black people, and particularly Black women, were able to go through trying situations and triumph. Now, before I tell these stories, I've got to set them in a time and place, because especially Alaska stories, they're kind of short because there hasn't been that much research on these women. But what they did was significant for them and for others, because after slavery ended, there was the Reconstruction. But the Reconstruction didn't reconstruct anything for Black people. They were not given any land. They weren't given any jobs. The government didn't provide schools. The government actually did nothing for Black people. So Black people in the South, many of them ended up working for their former owners or other people because who had plantations, because despite wanting to create another government, the wealthy plantation owners from the South were given subsidies so that they could rebuild. And so former slaves and poorer white people ended up becoming sharecroppers. They didn't own the land. They were working. They'd get some, maybe a little bit of the land for themselves and their family and a very little bit of money. And the situation wasn't too much better than slavery in terms of the actual conditions of people's day-to-day lives after slavery. Now, there was for a while a little bit of a heyday and some progress made immediately after the Civil War when there were Black men who were elected into state and even a few into the federal government. But that lasted a short time because, aside from not having the material resources, money, land, education, the wealthy plantation owners felt it to their benefit to create and build hatred among lower income white people against Black people. It served their political ends. It let them continue to make everybody work for them. And it was the roots of racism, which were not at all addressed at the end of slavery. So pretty soon, some of these people formed the Ku Klux Klan, which was a group of people who put on sheets and went around and literally terrorized and killed people. Then there was the whole period of lynching Black men, accusing them of raping or wanting or looking at white women. And the worst of those incidents that received the most attention was that of a young boy. And he was riding an elevator. So there is a level of hatred and violence that Black people in the South particularly suffered after the Civil War. But also, we should note that during the Civil War, Black people in New York suffered violence from white people because they didn't want to get drafted to fight in the Civil War. So it was like, you know, Black people were catching it coming and going. They weren't the ones drafting people, but they weren't the ones who had started the Civil War. They weren't the ones who had the plantations. But Black people were a good ploy for people in power and wanting money and wanting to not change things. So this was the life of Black people. Black women were still couldn't vote. There were still women considered second-class citizens, except they were considered third or fourth because white women were second-class citizens. And after slavery, and because during slavery, Black women worked just as hard and in the same places Black men did, unlike white women who didn't work of most incomes. Even lower income white women would usually do work more at home, or there was some employment, but not too much of employment of women in general in the 1800s. And it started to change at the early 1900s. So you've got women who see the life that white women have, where they don't have to work, where they can stay home and take care of their kids, or they're hiring Black women, the higher incomes, to come in and take care of their kids. So this is a life that is filled with frustrations, fear, but still a striving because there remains the one, belief in what this country stands for, which is freedom. And you grow up in this country, even then, that was what America was about. That was how, why the Civil War was fought. So it was that and quest for freedom and knowing what freedom means, not is just to be able to live a happy life, to be able to work, to be able to be with your family, to live without fear, to not have people look at you strangely, to not feel like you have to change the way you are naturally. All of these things were denied to Black people, and even more so to Black women after the Civil War. But there were some Black women who found their ways to Alaska. And one of the first one was born in 1884. And her name was Mattie Tootsie Crosby. And she came to Alaska from Maine. Now, they don't tell how she got into Maine, how her whole background of her family. I didn't have that. But she left Maine, which is a northern country, so she was used to being cold, and said that she came in the early 1900s. And she stayed briefly in Skagway. Then she took the Chilkoot Trail and went to Dawson. And she stayed in Dawson and then went to Iditarod in 1910. And while she was in Iditarod, and during that time of prohibition, she decided to help people out. And she made alcohol and had her own little bootlegging operation for a while. But she ended up getting caught and spent 6 months in jail in 1925. And after that, she left Iditarod and moved to Flat, Alaska. And I don't know, I've never heard of Flat, Alaska, but it was a small town south of Iditarod. And there she lived for most of the rest of her life. And she ended up starting a business in which she hired women to be helpful in entertainment for men, because there were more men in Alaska than women. So she became a businesswoman, serving hundreds of men and employing many women for decades. And she lived to be 90 years old and died in 1972, living in a retirement in one of the pioneer homes. So she was the first lady. Now, Zula Swanson was born in Jackson Gap, Alabama, in 1891. And she didn't like the South. And as soon as she became an adult, she left Alabama in the 1920s, went to Oregon, and then moved to Alaska. Now, along this way, she's been working. And she got into Alaska just as the Depression began. But because she'd been working and saving money, when she got to Anchorage, she was able to buy a building, which was on 5th and D Street in downtown Anchorage. And she was able to get this building with something like $1,000 down. She opened a hotel, a bar, and a club, and called it the Rendezvous Hotel. And it was a hotel. She had gambling there and adult entertainment. And she had good business. And she became known throughout Anchorage for her good knowledge of real estate, because she didn't stop with the Rendezvous. She purchased her property all over. She got her a home around Goose Lake, which they say is the lake where the University of Alaska is. And she bought a park. So she had a lot of land in Alaska for a Black woman, and she did well for herself. And not only did she work for herself, she helped other people. And she joined, she was a member of the NAACP and other civic and social clubs. And she said, Anchorage isn't a utopia, but it was the best decision I made at the time. And she stayed and died in Alaska, in Anchorage, in 1972. And when she died, they said she had over $500,000 in assets. So, but it didn't say if she had children or anything like that. So I don't know what the rest of her story is. Now, of these are three women who came in early and were engaged in business, kind of similar businesses. Now, Velma, Miss Wiggles Atkerson, said she was born in South Africa and moved to the United States after an elephant trampled her father. But most people said she was born in Atlanta, Georgia in 1922. But Miss Wiggles, as she came to be known because she was a dancer and a contortionist, was a natural storyteller. Because that the story of her birth, she told people that she was in performing in Jack Ruby's club when President Kennedy was assassinated, and other stories. But what is known that she was a performer, and she was actually a pretty strong person to be performing because she had polio when she was a child. So finding out how she overcame polio, became a dancer and a contortionist, is just like, if someone could find that out, I'd love to hear that story, because they said that she continued to perform and dance into her 80s. And she first began performing, she performed in New Orleans and San Antonio and Dallas in the 30s and 40s. And she opened and continued. And she opened for acts of white female performers, which was rare. She was beginning, it was an opening for the integration of performance artists. And then when she was in Alaska, she continued to perform in the Fairview section of Anchorage. And she performed at a whole lot of different nightclubs and entertainment. And she was very proud that she had her routines and her dancing, and each we had a modified striptease, but she said she never danced nude. And she did acrobatic performances. And she was featured in Ebony magazine in the early 1960s. And they said she was making $700 a week. And the book said that was $6,000 a week and $219. She was getting paid a lot of money for what she did, for her talents. But not only was she an entertainer, she was a woman who cared about other women. She took in homeless women. She took in women who had been abused. She took in abused children. And she was a seamstress. And she sewed for friends and for entertainers. And that kept her going into her 80s. And she died in 2012. Now, these next three women are women who were, I call, public servants. So the first one, well, are there any questions about the ladies we just talked about? Okay. So the first person I'm talking about is Mahala Ashley Dickerson. And she was born in Montgomery, Alabama in 1912 and graduated from Fisk University. And then she got a law degree from Howard University. And after she got a law degree, she returned to Alabama and became the first Black lawyer in that state in 1948. And she spent the six decades of her legal career primarily representing people who were facing discrimination. She practiced law for 3 years in Alabama. Then she went to Indiana, and she became the second Black woman admitted to the Indiana bar. So while she's working in Indiana, she's making good money, and she visits Alaska, and she likes it. Vacations. She does it a few times, and finally, she decides that she's going to settle in Alaska, and she became the first Black homesteader in 1958 with a 160-acre lot in Matanuska, Susitna Valley near Wasilla. And she also became the first Black lawyer in Alaska and had offices in Anchorage and Wasilla. She was on a precedent-setting case for equal pay for the University of Alaska faculty women. And she won a whole lot of awards. But the most prestigious one came from the National Lawyers Association, and it's called the Margaret Brent Award. And she won it in 1995, and she said, Ruth Bader Ginsburg got hers before me, but I got mine before Sandra Day O'Connor. And she wrote her autobiography in 1998 called Delayed Justice for Sale. Now, all of this stuff she did, and she raised three boys who were triplets and was a practicing Quaker. And she said, in my life, I didn't have but two things to do. Those were to stay Black and die. I'm just not afraid to fight something big. And that was Miss Dickerson. Now, Blanche Smith was born, well, she was born Blanche Lewis Preston in Marshall, Texas in 1920. And she was educated at Wiley College, a Black college, and then the University of Southern California. And she came to Alaska with her husband, Mr. Max Smith. And they became active in the NAACP. And now Alaska had an Anti-Discrimination Act that was initially passed in 1945. And it went through a few different iterations and people working to make it better. Because when they came in, they said it had a lot of shortcomings. Through her efforts on that, she was recognized by Alaska's first state governor, William A. Egan. And he appointed her to a vacant seat in the Alaska House of Representatives, making her the first Black person to hold that position. And she worked for the underrepresented and lower income populations in Alaska, the people who had a hard time getting housing and employment. And she worked she tried to get a state housing legislation passed without success, but they said she did pass a housing ordinance in Anchorage in 1967. In 1970, she became the director of the Office of the Governor for the Public Employment Program. And after she retired, she continued to be active in raising awareness about inequality and injustice. And she was editor for a time of the Alaska Spotlight, which is a Black newspaper that was founded by another man, but she edited it for a while. Now, our last lady from Alaska was named Eleanor William, and she was born in College Station, Texas in 1937. And in 1963, she, her husband, and seven children moved to Anchorage. And she worked for 5 years as a stenographer, but she had her eye on the skies because she wanted to do something more. And in 1968, the qualifications to be an air controller changed. You no longer had to have been a pilot or had to have had military experience. You just had to get trained. And she did that. She went to the schools, was trained, or the training, wherever they train air traffic controllers. In 1971, she was certified as an air traffic control specialist. And she worked at Anchorage Airport and moved from specialist to supervisor to another level to management and left in 1993. In 1994, she went to Oberlin, Ohio, and she was the first Black female manager of the Cleveland Air Traffic Control, which was at that time one of the most busy air traffic facilities. 3 years later, she was promoted to executive management for the FAA regional office in Chicago. That job was either so good or so hard that she retired in 1997, but she kept a home in Anchorage and one in Texas until she died in 2011. Now, she was active in the community and in getting women and Black people to become pilots. And in a speech she gave celebrating Martin Luther King Jr. in 1996, she said, "Be an agent of change, not a victim of change. It's easy to say it's not my problem, but I pledge to make a positive difference every day of my life for the rest of my life. I challenge you to make the same pledge."